You know, you wouldn't go in and put out this fire any more than you would go and turn aside a hurricane or a tornado. It doesn't work that way.
The Homer wildfire threatens more homes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 14th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Shell Oil hopes to avoid community misunderstandings in the Aleutians.
We got into the North Slope borough and we came in, people said like gangbusters, and people said, well, we didn't expect that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The wildfire burning near Homer has grown to more than 1,200 acres. By last night, 124 fire personnel were on scene 17 miles out on East End Road. At a briefing today, Matt Weaver from the Alaska Division of Forestry in Palmer said, despite fire lines made by five bulldozers, containment was a long way off. Weaver said sunny, dry weather and erratic winds have helped the fire to spread, along with huge amounts of unburned fuel.
We're in the pre-greenup season, and the grass ignites easily. It carries the fire well. With a little wind behind it, it can move quickly. And we have all this beetle kill, and that's the heavy fuel. So when the fire moves through, you know, some of that stuff's going to go up, but there's going to be pockets and little islands of unburned fuel that represent a huge hazard down the road, not only to homes and infrastructure, but to firefighters.
Weaver said there are two main objectives, to protect the public and firefighters and to protect property and infrastructure. Spot fires caused by rising warm air that lifts and drops burning embers are also a concern. Weaver said at least one structure was burned and several more are threatened. He emphasized that this is a long-term project.
You know, you wouldn't go in and put out this fire any more than you would go and turn aside a hurricane or a tornado. It doesn't work that way. This is a natural phenomena. Right now, we're in a pretty defensive posture. We're trying to keep fire south of the road, and we're concentrating our resources on structure protection.
The state's top firefighting unit, a Type 1 incident management team, is taking over operations this afternoon.
There's going to be a plans team. There's going to be an operations team with an aviation section. There will be a Type 1 incident commander. There will be an information machine. There will be other people like me moving into Homer and into the East End Road here over the next couple of days.
East End Road stretches 22 miles outside of Homer. Officials have set up a roadblock at mile 14. There are three Russian Old Believer villages where the road ends. An evacuation order was issued Wednesday afternoon, but Weaver said it was hard to assess how many people actually left their homes. The Red Cross has set up a shelter for displaced residents at the Homer High School. Alaska senators have introduced a bill that would require all oil tankers in Prince William Sound to be escorted by at least two tug vessels. Current law says only single-hulled tankers need the dual escort, but the new law would require them for double-hulled tankers also. The old law, the Oil Spill Pollution Prevention Act of 1990, was passed by Congress as a reaction to the Exxon Valdez oil spill and regulates the oil industry in Prince William Sound. Currently, tankers that operate in the port of Valdez are being replaced with double-hulled vessels, which have extra space between the hull and storage tank and are safer in a grounding accident. The last single-hulled tanker operating in Prince William Sound will be retired in 3 years. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she and Senator Mark Begich were concerned that the two-tug systems stay in place even when all the tankers are double-hulled.
One of the lessons that we learned from the Exxon Valdez is that you should never become complacent when it comes to security and safety. And I think by ensuring that we have the two-escort vessel system in place with the additional safety precautions of double-hulled tankers. I think it's just greater assurance that we will never see an environmental disaster like we saw with the Exxon Valdez again.
The senators have introduced the new legislation as a standalone bill. Murkowski says she doubts it will generate controversy, so it may be able to move through the Senate as is. Otherwise, she says, they're willing to pair it with any other compatible legislation. Alaska Congressman Don Young is working on a House version of the bill. Representatives from Shell Oil visited Unalaska this week to talk about their prospective involvement with offshore oil and gas drilling in the North Aleutian Basin. From member station KUCB, Ann Hillman reports.
Shell Oil General Manager Pete Slaby says they do not have any leases in the area. The leases have not been sold yet, but Slaby says Shell wants to keep communities aware of possibilities so they don't make the same mistakes as on the North Slope.
We got into the North Slope borough, and we, in 2006, and we came in, people said, like gangbusters. And all of a sudden, two drilling rigs, the Gilivar coming in to shoot a 3D seismic, baseline science work going on, geotechnical work, and people said, whoa, we didn't expect that. We want to understand a little more about what's going on.
He says it's too early to say how many wells they might drill or how many jobs might come to the region, though he projects it could be between 500 and 600. If the Outer Continental Shelf lease sales go through for the state of Alaska, the industry could provide an additional 35,000 jobs statewide. If the North Aleutian Basin lease sales open in 2011, Slaby says he's still not sure if Shell will bid.
We still haven't bid on anything and don't know that we, will, quite frankly, until we're working on looking at old seismic lines and seeing where we might have interest if the lease sale goes through.
Shell drilled 10 wells west of the currently proposed site in the 1980s and didn't strike any resources. They're examining seismic data for the currently proposed lease sale area to see if they see good commercial potential. The data was gathered in the 1980s and shows an image of the seafloor, the density of the rocks, and the potential location of liquids and gases underneath the ocean. Current data analysis indicates more potential for natural gas than for oil, and Slaby says they have about 20% chance of finding anything. He says they're also looking at baseline environmental data.
After we've looked at the seismic, we would look at, well, what would the cost be? And we'd also look at what would the impacts be. I mean, we really want to make sure that if we're developing and working in an area, it's an area that we can develop in a responsible way. It's hugely important for Shell. I think it's hugely important basically for everybody doing business in 2009.
He says Shell and the Minerals Management Service are trying to understand the impacts of OCS development on all levels of the ecosystem, including fish and crab populations that live in the area of the potential sale. When looking at the commercial potential of the area, Slaby says the lack of infrastructure might be an issue, but the potential workforce is encouraging.
The one thing this area does have in abundance is a really qualified workforce and people who are, I think with the pedigrees of the fishing industry, people who are reliant and conscientious and would, we think, fit pretty well with our plans. Because a lot of these jobs are rotational and give people opportunity time to pursue other kinds of activities.
In the past few years, Shell has used Unalaska as a staging ground for the work in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. Slaby says they will only do shallow water work in the north this summer for a few weeks and will not be using many of Unalaska's services. However, their operations in 2010 will be larger. The formal scoping period for the MMS to gather input on the North Aleutian Basin lease sales ended last fall, but they will still accept public comments on the issue. The next formal comment period should be in the winter of 2010 when the service releases the draft environmental impact statement. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a pretty parking garage for Juneau.
Nobody likes a parking garage. If someone comes up and says this parking garage is beautiful, I think it's the greatest compliment in the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens spent at least $1 million and as much as $5 million defending himself against federal charges that he failed to report gifts. Stevens filed a final financial disclosure with the U.S. Senate last week. It says he racked up legal bills between $1 million and $5 million since 2007. They're owed to the firm Williams & Connolly, which represented him in federal court last fall. Stevens also paid between $50,000 and $100,000 to another Washington, D.C. law firm, Utrecht and Phillips. The disclosure forms only asks for a range of payment, so it's unknown whether Stevens' legal bills are closer to the $1 million or the $5 million range. Senators must file annual financial disclosure statements, including a final termination report, when they leave office. The annual financial disclosure forms are what got Stevens into trouble with the Justice Department, which claimed that starting in 2001, he did not list on his forms gifts worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. In October, he was found guilty of lying on the forms, but last month the verdict was thrown out and all charges were dismissed because the Justice Department withheld evidence favorable to Stevens. He attached a letter to his final financial report mentioning the legal proceedings, saying even though the indictment was tossed out, he's not sure if he owes money to oilfield services company Vico and others for the alleged gift of renovations to his Girdwood home. Stevens set up a legal expense fund last fall with the Senate, but never filed disclosure forms for it. Now that he's out of office, he's not required to. Juneau is expected to start building a new downtown transportation center July 1st. The project includes a transit center for bus riders plus a trail to a hilltop park. But the item that's aroused quite a bit of controversy over the last few years is the four-level, 209-space parking garage. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has more.
If all the buildings in the world held a beauty pageant, and we're talking everything from malls to movie theaters, condos to castles, you wouldn't expect a parking garage to win the coveted crown. But this parking garage will be different, or so says project manager Jeff Wilson.
If you can admit that there is such a thing, I think it's going to be a very attractive parking garage.
So you think attractive parking garage is sort of an oxymoron?
It can be.
See, Wilson was the project engineer on the Marine Park Garage in 1985.
It was my very first project.
And in terms of attractiveness, he feels that one is, well,
kind of more, in my mind, questionable. I think that without the library, it would be harder to look at it and smile.
And that might be why, right off the bat, the architects of the new garage...
We were told very specifically by many people, don't do that, that being... the other parking garage here in town.
Sean Boyle is an architect with Northwind, the Juneau firm designing the downtown transportation center. And when he and partner James Bibb described the first garage...
It's heavy concrete, it's closed, it's dark. It's not a real welcoming building.
I'd say 90% of the parking garages in the country look like that. Your classic parking garage looks like a bombed-out building.
To avoid that bombed-out look at Juneau's downtown transportation center, the design team is balancing heavy concrete with light wood. The structure is concrete, but certain elements will be crafted from local cedar, such as the stairway handrails and the pedestrian canopies lining the building's exterior. City engineer Rory Watt says what he finds most interesting about the project
is we're building the garage in three ways so that it can be used differently in the future.
First, they're beefing up the floor of the upper open-air deck so it can physically support public events. The second feature involves the base of the garage.
There was an idea during the planning phases that the first floor ought to be something other than parking. A compromise was to build that first floor with a higher ceiling height. What it could be in the future, I don't know, but possibly something other than parking.
The third measure involves what Watt calls upgrading the structural members.
And by that, I mean the footings and the columns and the beams so that the building could be expanded upward and would support government complex on top of the hill.
So should a new Capitol building actually be built there someday, this facility could be part of that?
Absolutely. I think it would facilitate that.
And that's part of the reason Daniel Glidman is so excited about the garage.
A lot of people for some reason think that the building of that parking garage preempts a Capitol facility there, but it doesn't. It actually enhances the possibility.
Glidman has managed Merchants Wharf for 22 years and the Goldstein properties on Seward Street for 5. And as a longtime Junoite,
I've heard the weed won't come down and chop because there's no place to park for over 30 years.
But Glidman says parking can be tough for workers, too, like the state employees in the Goldstein properties.
There's about 25 spaces that are allocated for the state, and there's many more than 25 people that work in the building. So about every hour, a third of the building empties out and stops their productivity, and those lucky ones that have not gotten parking tickets look for more parking spaces.
So sort of a downtown car shovel.
It's kind of a downtown car shovel. It has been for many years.
As eagerly as Glidman anticipates the new garage, he isn't without concerns.
If you look at our existing parking garage and also the state office building, these dark black structures.
And Sean Boiley of Northwind says the team has received hundreds of pages of public comments and has tried to incorporate many into the project.
But there are always going to be people whose minds cannot be changed.
James Bibb, on the other hand, sees the glass a little more half full.
Nobody likes a parking garage. If someone comes up and says this parking garage is beautiful, I think it's the greatest compliment in the world. But if it's not as criticized as much as one would, then I think that would be a success in many ways.
In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
The recession is slowing private construction in Fairbanks, and there are mixed readings on what's to come. While government funding will bolster local military and infrastructure projects, privately financed activity appears to be declining. City of Fairbanks building official Steve Shuttleworth says the situation is hard to gauge because the city is coming off a string of several boom years.
It feels slower than in comparison to years past at this same time. That's based on permit activity, day-to-day contact, phone inquiries, applications before the Planning Commission, rezones, that kind of activity.
Shuttleworth says Fairbanks will have about a $70 million construction season that's well higher than average, but is propped up by construction of a new state fish hatchery and two big housing projects. Shuttleworth says the major component of recent years' commercial development, retail construction, is missing.
Box stores, all those plans have been postponed indefinitely.
Shuttleworth says carryover work from previous years will keep things relatively busy this summer, while some new smaller projects, including a wood pellet plant and charter school, are scheduled for construction. Big commercial projects go through the Borough Planning Commission, and planner Doug Sims says things are off to a slow start.
We really have set records in the last 5 years, so we are in that downturn, if you will, that I think actually is somewhat natural, but is now coinciding with the U.S. and the global downturn as well. So we're going to have an average year. I'm really not too concerned so much about this year because most of the projects we have are on the drawing board and are shovel ready. What I'm nervous about is next year.
Sim says one big project that was scheduled to go this summer has been delayed by the recession. The $3 to $4 million senior housing project is one of several nationwide being pursued by a company called Primrose. Local real estate agent Tom Roberts says the Fairbanks project was among several that fell victim to a tightened credit market.
Last year, when the funding dried up, they simply put all of those projects on hold. Although we didn't see it as much in Alaska, there was a lot of funding that was just stopped.
Robert says the commercial real estate market has been slow, but there is some light on the horizon, a hint of resurgence in residential real estate. The Borough Platting Office says several new small to medium subdivisions have been proposed.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
flood recovery operations are proceeding in Eagle. One of the first objectives of emergency managers is gaining road access to the old and new Native Village sites. The road there is blocked by a mile and a half stretch of broken river ice washed ashore during last week's record flood. State Incident Management Team liaison Al Cavallo says a new road is being punched through the woods to circumvent the ice.
They just hydroaxed a path coming off of the runway to the road that leads straight into New Village.
Cavallo says the approximately 4,000-foot road will be covered with tundra mats to allow heavy vehicles to travel over the soft ground. Ice and flooding toppled power poles to the villages, and portable generators are keeping freezers, pumps, and other essential appliances running. Alaska Power and Telephone is preparing to set up a larger generator to power up the village grid until transmission lines connecting it with the city's diesel plant can be repaired. The City of Eagle community well is contaminated with E. coli bacteria, and the Army National Guard has been trucking water in from Tok. Cavallo says there's also plenty of bottled water on hand and that large purifiers are being brought in. He says well water in the new Native Village, which did not flood, has tested clean. Much of the flood damage is still buried by ice along the waterfront, including the demolished health clinic and VPSO office in Old Eagle Village. Cavallo says the ice is slowing damage assessment, salvage, and cleanup.
The main debris is going to be under the ice at this point. Of course, you got a lot of houses that have been damaged. You have houses on top of houses. You know, some houses have been, you know, elevated 30 feet, you know, just by the ice. And so those are the kind of things that are going to involve a little bit more structured removal procedures. And, of course, you're going to have contractors come in here and being gentle with this stuff, allowing people to gain access to get their property.
Cavallo says citizens are being asked to sort through items strewn around by the flood so that potentially contaminated materials can be disposed of. A representative from State Occupational Safety and Health is assessing hazards, and the Department of Environmental Conservation is securing fuel tanks and cleaning up spills. Cavallo says the ice is slowly melting and that some property owners have been into flood-damaged structures to retrieve belongings. He says the state will have to tread carefully when it comes to moving buildings pushed onto roads or neighboring land.
We collectively, you know, as a government, just can't go in there and start hauling stuff around. So that's going to require a coordinated effort, you know, amongst the community members.
Cavallo says the state will work to ensure everyone's rights are protected. He says most Eagle area residents displaced by flooding are living with friends and neighbors, and that finding temporary housing for them is the next step. He says one possibility is to bring in trailers. State Temporary Housing Officer Nora Furman has been assessing needs in the Eagle area.
What I have are 13 households that have been majorly impacted in the Eagle area and 11 households in the Eagle Native Village area.
That comes out to 39 people displaced by the flood. She says preliminary estimates on the cost of damage to private property are beginning to be calculated.
Business losses in the Eagle area are going to exceed $850,000, and we know it's probably going to be over $1 million. And I have approximately $650,000 worth of damage for homeowners in Eagle.
Furman says figures for the old Native Village and public infrastructure are not included in those numbers. She says an overall economic impact study of cost of the flood is in the works. State officials anticipate flood recovery projects at Eagle to span into next year. How do you express modern concepts and terms in an endangered native language spoken fluently by few people? Each month, elders from around Kodiak meet to tackle that question, developing new words in Aleutic for English words such as computer and internet in order to help the language evolve with the times. From member station KMXT, Eric Wander reports.
The New Words Council is a major component of the Aleutic Museum's Aleutic Living Words Project, an extensive project designed to increase knowledge and revitalization of the language. The council met last week in Old Harbor. April Lectonen Counselor is the Aleutic Language Manager at the Aleutic Museum, and also the project manager for the Living Words Project. According to Counselor, Aleutic words usually consist of a root word with any number of suffixes attached. She said the new words the Council creates tend to be literal, either based on function, what the word sounds like, or a direct translation. The Council created and debated a number of such new words at its most recent meeting.
We created a new word for restaurant, which is nohwik, as well as cafeteria, which is nohwikwak, which means kind of like a restaurant. And the word for restaurant literally means place to eat. They also voted on a word for Fairbanks, which I can't remember, the city of Fairbanks. I can't remember what the final decision was on that. I think there was a discussion about the word for electricity, but we still couldn't come up with a final answer on that. There was a word they discussed for electric blanket. A lot of times words will stay on the agenda for a number of months because elders are taking it so seriously. They want the word to not only make sense, but to make sense for future generations as well, and also follow the linguistic rules of the language.
Counselor said elders create about 5 new words each time the council meets. Other recent additions to the language include Aleutic words for credit card, barista, ketchup, and television. However, she hasn't heard many of the new words being used regularly, at least not just yet.
I think the elders see themselves as creating these words for the next generation of fluent speakers, the ones that we're hoping to reach with our Aleutic Language Revitalization Program. And a couple of the words that they have used in the council, the elders are using. But for the words that don't come up in conversation very often, at least among the elders, like computer or internet, because they don't really talk about those things in their daily life, they're not really using those new words, but we have them written down. We're working to get them recorded and put up on our website so that when people in the schools start to learn the language, they'll have words for the things that are around them.
Counselor said the New Words Council has been meeting since 2007, when the project was first funded by a grant from the National Science Foundation. She said that with a year left on the grant, the future direction elders on the council choose to take has yet to be determined.
We'll probably be deciding over the course of the next year if it's something that the elders want to continue doing or if it's going to be changed in some way. We're actually talking about creating an old words council because when we get this number of fluent speakers together, it's really amazing to have that amount of brain power all together at once. So we always end up asking them not just to create new words, but to remember old words that people don't use very much anymore, words that we may have heard one elder use, but we're not sure if all the other elders know that word, or a word that may have been noted in an explorer's notebook when the Russians were here, but no one's heard it since, and the linguists want to know, oh, is that still in use? And so sometimes the New Words Council starts to take on all these other different purposes.
Counselor estimates that there are about 56 fluent Aleutic speakers on Kodiak Island or from Kodiak and now living elsewhere. She hopes to compile a comprehensive list of fluent speakers in consultation with elders within the next year. The Aleutic Living Words Project is funded by the National Science Foundation's Documenting Endangered Languages Program. The Aleutic Museum's website features project and language updates along with audio clips, and the museum plans to launch a new online language learning tool soon. I'm Eric Wander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Marsha Lynn in Homer, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Eric Wander in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Susanna Caldwell is our intern. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.